Jamie, Israel, of course, makes the claim that it's simply fighting a war of self-defense, the fighting for its own existence, if you will. President Biden said at a fundraiser at Radio City Music Hall in New York, and I quote him, "You can't forget," he said, "that Israel is in a position where its very existence is at stake," close quote. What's your reaction to that claim?
Well, I think Biden's comment is both true and false. So it's false because, as Colter Lewis meticulously documents in his chapter in the book, Israel had chance after chance after chance since 1967, when its occupation began, to resolve its conflict with the Palestinians on reasonable terms, which is to say, on terms consistent with international law. The PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which was the leading Palestinian organization for many decades, it was willing to reach a two-state solution with Israel as far back as the mid-1970s. And then even with Hamas, after it was elected in 2006, it repeatedly made diplomatic overtures to the US, to the UN, to the EU, to the whole international community, indicating that it would be willing to engage in dialogue with a view to reaching a negotiated settlement of the conflict. And in his chapter in the book, Colter Lewis documents those overtures exhaustively. Now, regrettably, the US and Israel, instead of pursuing those opportunities for peace, they systematically sabotaged and spurned them. And the reason why Biden's comment is in this respect misleading is that the reason Israel and the U.S. rejected all those offers, it wasn't out of fear of Israel's existence, because, of course, a negotiated settlement of a conflict would have provided for Israel's existence. Instead, the reason Israel rejected all of those opportunities was to secure its illegal occupation of Palestinian land. So in that sense, Biden's claim is just false. However, after October 7th, the claim that Israel is engaged in an existential struggle, I think it does carry more weight. Israel's security doctrine, basically, to boil it down, it relies on the Arab world's fear of it, and now Iran's fear of it as well, what Israel calls its deterrence capacity. Now, that deterrence capacity took a really devastating blow on October 7th, as this tiny, you know, relatively ragtag militia, Hamas, was able, even though it was under siege and Israeli surveillance for two decades, it was able to penetrate, apparently with ease, Israel's high-tech perimeter. And so Israeli planners now fear, I think rationally, that unless they are able to inflict a complete military defeat of Hamas and or a sack of Gaza that will ring through the ages, then its enemies in the region, notably Hezbollah in Lebanon, will conclude that they can defeat Israel on the battlefield. And so in that sense, I do think that Israel's existence does look imperiled now in a way that it really didn't between 1948 and October 6, 2023.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with Jim Lafferty, my former law partner and co-host of Law & Disorder Radio. We're speaking with the editor of a new book, Jamie Stern Wiener, has just published Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. It's just a terrific book, 12 chapters. It's the initial big book to come out about Gaza. There'll be others, but I'm not sure anything's going to top this. John Mersheimer said, first-rate analysis, a truly important antidote. And we're very pleased to have Jamie on the show with us. Jamie, I wanted to ask you about the atrocity, no other way to describe the conclusion to the 2018 Great March of Return that the people in Gaza staged marching up to the wall. It was a nonviolent reaction to the oppression of Palestinians in Gaza. Please describe that oppression, and what did Israel do to that Great March? And do you think that that was a turning point?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you've asked me about that, because I think those 2018 protests in Gaza and what happened to them a really crucial context to understanding why we got to where we are now. And that's why the book includes a whole chapter on them, which goes through the record in detail. The protests in 2018, they were organized by Independent Guard and Civil Society. And then after they took off, the various factions, including Hamas, facilitated them, provided transportation, and so on. In my view, that protest campaign was one of the most inspiring and humbling episodes, really, in the history of mass nonviolent resistance. Every week, you had tens of thousands of people, ordinary Gazans, assembling along that perimeter fence and demonstrating for their rights as refugees and for an end to the illegal, suffocating blockade that Israel was imposing on them. Now, all the human rights organizations that have investigated this and the exhaustive UN inquiry, they agree these marches were overwhelmingly nonviolent. I'm talking about the period March 2018 up to their kind of culmination, their peak in May. Now, in response, Israeli snipers were arrayed along Israel's side of the perimeter fence, and they just systematically, in a kind of methodical, leisurely way, targeted unarmed protesters in Gaza with live ammunition. And the UN report documents this in exhaustive detail. Those Israeli snipers shot children, they shot journalists, they shot paramedics, and they shot disabled people. They shot people who were nowhere near the perimeter fence, including people who were walking away from the fence. All told, more than 6,000 demonstrators were injured with live sniper ammunition. Now, I think any nonviolent movement would struggle in the face of that level of lethal repression. But what really did it for the 2018 Great March of Return in Gaza was that the international community, which I'm afraid to say is all of us, we didn't mobilize to stop Israel from gunning those peaceful protesters down. Of course, anyone familiar with Martin Luther King, with the US Civil Rights Movement, with Gandhi, will know nonviolent resistance only works if spectators are moved by the sight of brutal repression to intervene and to stop it. But the world did not intervene in 2018, and so the nonviolent option in Gaza failed. And I think the reason that's important to understand, if you put that episode together with what we were just talking about, namely Hamas's diplomatic overtures in 2006, which were met with rejection, it helps to explain why October 7th happened, and then, of course, why the genocidal campaign Israel responded with happened. Namely, Gazans tried the diplomatic option to secure the end to that siege. They also tried in 2018 the nonviolent resistance option. And those tactics were exhausted. They failed. And therefore, I think it's wholly unsurprising that the people of Gaza resorted last October to violence.